Okay, let's resume. The next item on the board's agenda is 2005-2006, number 82, concerning peace. For the record, the time is 2:17 p.m., and again, now sitting on the board as the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services is Dan Carton, who is the Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services. Number 82 is back before us on a motion for rehearing submitted by Mr. Pink as one of the proponents. Mr. Pink, I'll turn it over to you for your arguments in support of your motion for rehearing.
Oh, well, as we spoke last time, I had suggested that the phrase "peace is possible" be moved to the front of the title, and I had specifically asked if there was any statutory authority requiring that the title be set up in a certain way, and the answer I received was that there was no specific statutory authority regarding the wording of the title. And then I believe, Mr. Hobbs, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. That you told me that that was the way that they had historically done it, and that I guess there was a long period of time that that had always been handled that way, where the subject comes at the last. And I was wondering, do you have any examples? I mean, when you say historical and you don't have any statutory authority to back you up, I'm just curious as to how you came up with having to put it at the back. And on that, I'd like to discuss that. That's the reason I think that there should be another rehearing, because I don't think that you didn't give me, at least as a person, sufficient cause or, you know, belief that your interpretation of how a title is supposed to be set was necessarily the correct one.
Well, I wouldn't say there's no statutory or other legal authority. There are some statutory and legal requirements that, that the board does try to comply with, which I think result in the structure that it typically follows. And for example, one of them is that the board is required by statute to clearly express the single subject of the measure. And so that forces the board to say concerning something. That is the way the board expresses the subject of a measure. The board's also required by statute to follow the same rules as the General Assembly follows in setting titles. So again, our titles are basically structured the same as the titles of legislation of bills before the General Assembly. So, and as far as examples, I think, you know, really any of the titles that the board has set, in my experience, do follow that same basic structure.
But again, could you reference the statute? You said that there's the General Assembly handles legislation a certain way. Could you reference that, please?
Well, the specific section, I believe, is 1-40-106.5, and then it's and I don't have time to try to pull it out from that section or from the Constitution, but I'd refer you to Article 5, Section 1, and I think it's subsection 7.5, but I'm not sure that that's the, it may be 5.5. But those are the two primary provisions in the law now that deal with the setting of titles. And actually I should refer to 1-40-106 and 107.
But again, say you don't have time to pull it out. I told you last time I'm not a lawyer, but you know, you have great authority here. So I understand that this is your job to respectfully answer my questions, and I'm very curious as to where in 140-106-5 or 106 or 107 or Article 5, Section 1 of the Constitution, that there's anything that says that you have to put the subject at the end of the sentence.
Well, actually, we have to put it at the beginning. I mean, it's the one thing that is required is that we express the single subject of the measure. And this is your opportunity. You know, you filed the motion for rehearing, and this is your opportunity to provide the arguments that to explain why you disagree with what the board did.
Right.
We did have this discussion last time, so I don't particularly want to repeat it.
No, I'm only going to talk for a few minutes. I guess I just misunderstood something you said. Did you just say that single, that, and can I ask a question before we go on? We're all agreed that this is a single subject. I think we voted it.
That's correct.
Okay. Did you just say that the single subject goes at the beginning?
I said the board is required. I may have said it at the beginning, but the board, in this case, there is nothing except the expression of the single subject, so there's no other place to put it, since the entire title consists of the expression of the single subject.
Okay, so could you give a hypothetical example today of what you think the title should be? Because I'm honestly confused a little bit, because when we talked last time, I thought that the conclusion I came away with was that it had to go at the end, and now I'm a little confused. Are you saying that there's a single subject? Yes. And that basically the single subject is the entire body of the proposal. And are you saying now it goes at the front? And maybe we're not at this point. I guess I'm still trying to convince you to have this rehearing. Is that correct?
Well, we are here on your motion for rehearing.
Right.
And this is your opportunity. This is a hearing to consider your motion and to hear your arguments why the board was in error last time when it set the titles that it set.
Well, again, and I'm still confused. Would it be permissible for the board at this time to give me a sample of what you think the title should be today? Because I'm being very honest with you. I'm confused, because last time you said at the end, and now if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying this time at the beginning. So could you give a sample of what you think it should be so that I don't waste everybody's time if we're in agreement on this? I know everybody wants to, you know, get out of here early, and I certainly have things to do, and I appreciate your gentleman's time and Ceci's time too. So if maybe we could just kind of jump to that, then hopefully we can wrap this up.
Mr. Dunn.
I think what he was referring to is, if you remember the previous measure we just had up, if I think you were here for that.
I didn't listen to anything he said.
If you that had a very long title. So the first clause said an amendment to the Constitution regarding the Public Employees Retirement Association.
Mm-hmm.
And then it went on to say what the measure does.
Okay.
When he said that the single subject has to be up front, he's referring to that clause. So while in that sentence, the word para was at the end of that, or of that clause, the word para was at the end of that clause, that statement of the single subject had to be at the front of the title.
Right.
So that's the first clause. In your case, there only is the single subject clause. There's nothing else. It doesn't go on to say what the measure does, because it's only three words and it's included in the single subject statement.
Right.
The other point I would add is that the purpose of setting a title is not to make a declaration of policy or a pronouncement of law or anything else, but rather to pose a question to the public,
right,
about whether or not the Constitution should be amended. That is the subject, that is the purpose of the title. We obviously, it's not to make a statement of policy or anything else. So the fact that this is an amendment to the Constitution is the paramount issue in the title.
Okay.
And as you would state any question in conversation, should we amend the Constitution to do X, Y, and Z?
Okay.
That's the natural way of saying it.
Okay, well, I appreciate you taking a few minutes to explain that to me. There are just a couple other points that I would like to present in the hopes of convincing the board to change their mind, and this will really only take a minute. And I wanted to start with a quote by Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. He said in a case called Olmstead v. United States in 1927, "Government will be imperiled if it fails to observe the law scrupulously. Our government is the potent, the omnipresent teacher. For good or for ill, it teaches the whole people by its example." And as you know, I'm trying to amend Article 27 of the Constitution, which clearly prohibits detonation of nuclear weapons inside Colorado without a vote of the people and an insurance policy. And I guess what I'm trying to do is, I'd like the people to be asked about nuclear weapons that would be leaving Colorado for other destinations. As maybe some of you members of the board are aware, the District of Colorado has, as best I can figure out, about 150 ICBMs scattered across the northern area outside of Fort Collins up by the Wyoming border. And I guess what I would like to do is, maybe I'll offer an alternative to that, and The thing is, I'm not necessarily sure how to do that, and my feeling is that perhaps amending Article 27 at this time in our society and where we're going through is not necessarily the best solution for that. But the reason I brought up the Justice Brandeis quote from Olmsted is that I think we can set a better example than nuclear weapons, and basically they're called, I'm really only going to talk for another couple minutes, they're called non-lethal weapons, and this is an article from Time magazine, July 29th, 2002. There's a two-page article about different types of non-lethal weapons. One of them here is projectiles. They're called tunable bullets. We're talking about dialing in the penetrating power. It's the difference between set phasers to stun and set phasers to kill. This is the New York Times magazine from October 23rd, 2005. And it's about a gentleman, an officer from West Point who went to Iraq. And basically the whole article talks about how they tried to adapt non-lethal weapons in Iraq and how it didn't necessarily work. And it begins, the article begins, non-lethal response, probably mentions non-lethal weapons about 11 times in there. But the real reason I got interested in non-lethal weapons is that in, I believe this is 1996, the United States Air Force Institute for National Security Studies at the United States Air Force Academy came out with the non-lethal weapons terms and references. This is basically, it's, let's see here, 94 pages that the military has come up with of non-lethal weapons. I realize it's probably not going to change your mind about the way the title should be set, but can I submit this to the board, make it part of the record?
Yes, you can. Sure. And if you'll give it to Ms. Gomez, it'll become a part of the record.
And the last thing is, just to finish up real briefly, is some of you may know the Civic Center Park is going to be redeveloped. It's pretty worn down. I think it's a great space, and I'm a graduate student at the University of Colorado Denver in urban and regional planning. And what I really think is that peace is possible is not necessarily appropriate for Article 27 this time in our nation's history, but I think it would be really good if that were the park registry, Civic Center Park. And part of why I'm talking to you about this is I want to make this part of the public record, is that I think that we should put Peace is Possible as the park registry for Civic Center Park. And what I call it is the Codex Americana. And I want to translate Peace is Possible into all the different languages of the world and have them displayed at Civic Center Park. And then I want to have people come sign the park registry, so anyone who agrees with Peace is Possible can have a record of it. And I think maybe that's the more appropriate way to at least start getting people to think about Peace is Possible. And I just made this quick picture. I'd like to submit that, and then I'll be finished.
If you'll give that to Ms. Gomez also. Thank you.
That's really all I have to say at this point. I very much appreciate your time, taking your time to listen to me. And I think it's very important that this process be available to people. And I know you're taking time out of your busy day. I think it's important to us as a people that we start talking about these issues. And obviously the ballot measure is one way we can do that. And I feel honored and privileged that I've had this opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you, Mr. Payne.
Thank you.
I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify before the board? If not, I'll turn to board discussion concerning the motion for rehearing. Any discussion by the board? I guess I would offer that, you know, the measure is very short. It simply declares that peace is possible. The title set by the board last time simply say simply express what the measure simply expresses, and it seems to me the title set by the board at the last meeting are proper. So I guess I would just go ahead and make a motion that the motion for rehearing be denied. Is there a second for that?
Second.
I think Mr. Dunn seconded that. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That does conclude action on number 82.
Thank you.
And the time is 2:32 p.m. Thank you. Okay, let's turn to the next item on the board's agenda. That is 2005-2006, number 95, Education of English Language Learners. This is before the board on a motion for rehearing, submitted by Ed Ramey. Mr. Ramey, if you'd like to come forward and give us your comments concerning the motion for rehearing, please.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. We filed a motion which ticks off six items, and I'd like to take a little bit out of order, if I may, because I think some of them are very perfunctory, and Mr. Bodine, representing proponents, and I did have a telephone discussion yesterday, I believe, and I think we have an understanding of at least what I would recommend and his position on it. The two I want to hold for the end of my comments are items numbers 1 and 2, which I think probably pose the most difficult question as far as the board is concerned and he may be concerned today. But first, if I could just turn to items 3, 5, and 6 on the list that we provided the board in our motion. 5 and 6 in particular are just inserting the word annual with regard to English proficiency tests and the mandated assessments. We would submit that the fact that these are just not occasional assessments or once-in-a-decade assessments, but in fact are annual with the implicit, I wouldn't say necessarily diversion, but commitment of manpower, person power, and funds to accomplish this is something the voters should be aware of. But those are very simple adjustments to make. Number 3, somehow the old phrase, English Immersion Program, which is reflective of the initiatives a few years back in 2000 and 2002, I believe, surfaced in the title but does not appear in the text of the initiative itself, and propose that the language of this particular initiative be used. I'm not quite sure what English immersion is, but it did have a meaning under the old initiatives. It's not here, and in fact might constitute a catchphrase, depending on whether that phrase has achieved more public acceptance as a meaning. I don't think we have any difficulties with Mr. Bodine on that, but I'll defer to his comments when he gets up here. Number 4, if I could turn to that, is the question of how often the waivers need to be mandated. Again, under the old initiatives back in 2000 and 2002, the requirement in the text of the provision was that waivers be applied for by the parents of the students annually. The annual requirement does not appear, at least I can't find it, in the text of the present initiative. So, in fact, the waivers could be applied for, I guess, as designated by the Board of Education or somebody, or whoever, but there's no constitutional annual requirement in the text of this particular initiative. Now, Mr. Bodine can comment on what his intent or the proponent's intent may have been with regard to that, but I think it's important that the title not insert a temporal provision that does not appear in the text. Finally, we come to items 1 and 2, and this is old. I'm sorry Mr. Kneiser's not here because he and I have been down this road repeatedly, but this is the issue that went up to the Supreme Court twice in 2000, again in 2002, and ultimately resulted in a title being affirmed by the Supreme Court. The text of the present initiative does precisely, if my recollection is correct, what the text of the old initiatives did in terms of the availability of a waiver, the constraints on the availability of a waiver, and the practical availability of non-accelerated English or non-English immersion classes to waive into. The only thing missing is the old provisions had extensive punitive measures directed at teachers and school administrators and so forth, which would have denied them employment in government and as teachers in the state in the event of a violation, and provided civil rights of action and so forth. But the basic requirement that you would need two things. Number one, the availability, the very constrained availability of the waiver for children 10 years of age or older and with special needs only, on the one hand. And number two, in order to have a non-accelerated English program available, you would need 20 students, as the text of the measure reads. You would need 20 students at a grade level qualifying for one of these limited availability waivers at a particular school. Now, Mr. Bodine and I did discuss it. Mr. Bodine, I believe, has a different interpretation of the text of the measure, or at least a different interpretation of the intent behind the text of the measure. But I would submit to the board that notwithstanding that, the text of the measure says 20 students at a grade level at a given school. The result of that, particularly outside of the Denver area, is practically, as I think the Supreme Court recognized on two prior occasions, is that the effectiveness or availability of a waiver with a place to waive into will be extremely limited. Now, having said that, back in 2002, the Supreme Court did provide language, or the board actually came up with some language, which the Supreme Court did approve. I have that language here, and I suppose you all have it as well. You voted it, Mr. Hobbs, last time. That language, if I can locate it, I will put it on the record. The language that appeared in what became Amendment 31 back in 2002 had a qualifying phrase after the reference to the waiver provision that read as follows: but making such waivers very difficult to obtain because the school can grant them only in very restrictive circumstances and can deny them for any reason or no reason, thereby reducing the likelihood that bilingual education will be used. And as I recall, we at that time were continuing to challenge even the adequacy of that provision because of the problem that results from you having to get 20 students qualifying for a waiver at a grade level at a particular school before a bilingual or other non-accelerated English program would even be offered. Supreme Court did not entertain that argument and did accept the language that I just quoted. So I would submit that the severe constraints on the waiver, at least using language such as the Supreme Court approved the third time around 4 years ago, 5 years ago, would be necessary in this case. The constraints on the waiver and the availability of programs to wade into are equally as constrained as they were back then.
Questions for Mr. Ramey? Mr. Ramey, I do have at least one question for you, if you wouldn't mind. Sorry. I think there, and I'm going to need some help here to see if I'm right about this, but I think there may be an important difference between the text of the measure before us and the text that was before the Supreme Court and the board in 2002. And I think it's really important with respect to the waivers. And it has to do with, in the current version, there is a provision, if I can find it here, that says it's in the parental waiver subsection 5, about 10 or 12 lines down. It says school district officials decide whether to grant or deny the request for the waiver based on rules established by the state board, which guidelines shall consider the best interest of the child in their formulation. And I don't remember, and I could not find in the 2002 version a comparable provision that said that the waiver decision would be based on rules of the board.
I think you're correct, Mr. Hobbs. There was nothing, I think, remotely like that in the old provisions.
And to me, that's significant because of some of the language that was in number 31 in 2002, I think, has now been addressed perhaps by at least that particular change. And I was sitting on the board at the time. I think when the Supreme Court ruled that the board's titles were inadequate on this score and remanded it to the board, we struggled with how to express what the Supreme Court had said about the difficulty of the waiver process. And I think, as you alluded to, I think really what the board did was pretty much use some of the language out of the court's opinion. And I don't know how accurate my memory is, but in any event, what the title for number 31 said, and you just read it, but I want to focus on one part of it. I mean, it does express that the waivers are difficult for certain reasons, but it goes on, you know, included in that, the title for number 31 said, they can deny them for any reason or no reason. And I think that part of it, at least, has been addressed by the fact that this version says it's governed by the rules adopted by the board. It wouldn't be for any reason or no reason. It would have to be for reasons that are based on the rules of the state board. And to me, it makes a big difference.
But I would not quibble with that. I think the phrase that was in the Amendment 31 title, which did in fact reflect language, as I recall, and I can recall our discussion over that at the time, did say specifically that the waiver could be denied for any reason or no reason. The state board approval provision was not present. I certainly wouldn't quibble that particular language, and can deny them for any reason or no reason, would not be, I don't think it would be appropriate, let alone required in the present title. So I would agree, Mr. Hobbs, with you on that. I think what remains the same, nevertheless, is the fact that the waivers are only available to a very confined, restricted group of people, number one. And number two, the waiver is only effective. And I remember we had extensive discussions. We're being a little unfair to Mr. Levine because he wasn't present for those at the time, but we had extensive discussions about what are you waiting into, and are we really dealing with a sham, as the Supreme Court, with regard to the older initiatives, quoted us as suggesting, and I think agreed with us in one of their opinions, in that you have to have something to wade into, and there will be nothing to wade into unless you can find 20 students at the same grade level in a particular school, all of whom either have special needs or are 10 years of age or older, and all of whom have applied for a waiver or out of an accelerated English class into a bilingual or a class. That would make it extremely unlikely, I think, was the court's point, that the waivers would mean anything, even if somebody were able to qualify for them. There'd be no place to go other than possibly be bused across the state to a school in Denver that would qualify. So I think that concern remains the same. But your point about the any reason or no reason is correct. That language is now gone.
Well, and I guess probably where I'm headed, subject to the more discussion here, is that probably the board does need to say something about the difficulty of the waiver process based on the Supreme Court's decision last time. But doesn't have to go so far as it did last time.
Well, I don't think you need to call it a sham. I don't think, and you didn't last time, I don't think you need to include the language that we just spoke about. In fact, I think it would be inappropriate to do it because it's not in this initiative. But virtually everything else that's there, and I'm using the Supreme Court's, the language that the board adopted last time that the Supreme Court approved as something of a guide here because it worked. I'm not particularly happy with that language. I challenged it at the time, but it's the Supreme Court said it was okay, so I'm not going to revisit that those words with them, and the underlying issue is precisely the same.
Well, let me try to think out loud here and get your reaction to it. I'm interested in pursuing the idea of maybe amending the titles to maybe at least add language. I think it's in line 9, requirements for the waivers, you know, at establishing requirements for the waivers, and say something like establishing requirements for the waivers that make obtaining the waiver, or making it very difficult to obtain the waivers. And not saying, identify yourself.
Okay, my name is Joseph Bodine. I'm counsel for the proponents of this measure. I do have some suggestions on how we might make some changes in the title that will address not all, but the majority, mm-hmm. I think, of his the concerns that they have with the title. If I could present those to you, and then see if that would.
Mr. Ramey, do you have any objections?
I have no objections. In order, I guess, to facilitate a little efficiency here, could I raise one other point unrelated to this?
Sure. Yeah.
If I might have an opportunity.
Yeah, Mr. Bodine, if you don't mind, then let's have Mr. Ramey finish up, and then we'll hear from
him. This will just take.
If you were going to make suggestions, I thought we'd just try and get it all.
Well, I was actually trying to get something out just so that he could respond to it, but go ahead, Mr. Ramey.
I'll respond however you want to. I'm sure I would like it, but whatever. One other point, actually, Mr. Garcia, one of my clients, pointed it out to me, and it's related to point number 6 that I forgot to mention a moment ago. We're referring to the, to point number 5, excuse me, the English proficiency test. The title uses language that says, if I can quote it, test of academic subject matter given in English. The measure itself uses language, test of English. And I apologize because this was not explicitly stated in our motion, but it does relate to point number 5. And let me be specific about where these are. The text of the language, section 7A, the first and second line, says to ensure the progress English learners. I think there's a word missing there. There's a word of missing in the text, but a standardized, nationally accepted test of English proficiency shall be administered. So we have a standard, nationally accepted test of English proficiency. Whatever that is, it sounds to me like what that is, and I'm not sure, but it's a test of English skills. But the language is what it is. In the title, this has been transposed into, and I'm talking about lines 16 and 17 of the title, starting on line 15, a standardized nationally accepted test of academic subject matter given in English, which sounds to me like a test of geography and history and chemistry and so forth in English. I'm not sure, and frankly, I don't read those two as the same things. I may be wrong, but the way to resolve that, obviously, is to have text is supposed to be, have the title reflect that language. So if I can throw that in as related to point number 5, I would like to do that as well. Now, I would encourage Mr. Bodine's comments on the waiver issues. I would just like a moment to respond to whatever gets generated out of that.
Oh, and before you go, then Mr. Dunn has a question too. Sorry.
Mr. Ramey, on your point number 4, that the title's misleading.
Right.
Say there's nothing in the text of the initiative limiting the ability of a school district to provide a waiver of duration of any length.
Is there one? Did I miss one?
Well, no, but my question is, is that really true? And you can enlighten me sort of on this. Is a student, can they grant a multi-year waiver? Isn't a student sort of have to enroll in a school each year? I mean, could they?
Well, a student has to enroll each year. I don't know if a multi-year waiver could be provided or not. I suppose that's something that would have to be determined by the state board or the schools or somebody. But the measure itself doesn't limit it to 1 year. Now, the old measures of a few years ago did very clearly require that parents come in annually. That was part of the constitutional provision. But this one doesn't do it. So, I mean, I don't know the answer to your question, but I don't think it's mandated. I don't think there's anything in present law that would mandate it.
I was just thinking if it was inherent in the system that, you know, my
I have one child, but they're not old enough to be in school yet. But if you have to annually prove residency and sign up and do all those kinds of things, that would seem to me a waiver could not be granted for longer than you're eligible to be a student. But
you may be right, and yet I can't see any reason why a school couldn't say as long as you're enrolled here, or for the next 2 years, if in fact you're enrolled here for that duration of time, the waiver would be out.
Okay, thanks.
Assuming the state board rules, which we don't know anything about at this point, they agree with that. But the initiative itself, the text of the initiative, does not include that limitation.
Mr. Carton.
You're trying to get away, Mr. Carton. Just one question, Mr. Ramey. I wanted to follow up on what Mr. Hobbs's his last comment before we get too far down the road. His suggestion, and then I want to just ask you a quick question about the language of your motion for hearing, and I'll try to do this as cogently as I can, but I think Mr. Hobbs' suggestion for consideration is on lines 8 and 9, at the end of line 8, and the beginning of line 9, where the language says, in establishing requirements for the waivers, to add something to the effect that conveys the message that it's difficult, restrictive, limiting circumstances to get those waivers, to get a waiver. And going back to the Supreme Court's opinion on 21 and 22 and the language of ballot measure number 31, where it talked about, as you read, making such waivers very difficult to obtain because the school can grant them only in very restrictive circumstances. That was the language of ballot measure 31 in 2002. And in your motion for rehearing, in paragraph 1, you state that while failing to, and I'm just taking the relevant piece here, while failing to disclose that the effect of the initiative in A, severely limiting the circumstances in which a waiver may be obtained. And I think we've established that the current measure before us leaves to the State Board of Education the determination of the guidelines that a school would employ to grant the waiver. And specifically, I'm looking at the language, school district officials decide whether to grant or deny the request for the waiver based on rules established by the State Board of Education, which guidelines shall consider the best interests of the child in their formulation. And that's new language. And so, My simple-minded way of seeing things here, we're talking about two things. First is granting the waiver, and then the next thing is, if you get the waiver, do you have any place you can go to school?
Absolutely.
For your bilingual ed? But for purposes of granting the waiver, I think for the old language where it says the school can grant them only in very restrictive circumstances, and in your motion, you state that the title fails to disclose that the effect of the initiative is to give those waivers or severely limiting the circumstances in which the waiver can be obtained. My question to you is, how can we know what those circumstances are?
Well, we know the basic constraints within which the waiver can be obtained. 10 years
right.
of age or older, and special circumstances or special needs, I think is the language. Whatever the state board does by way of its guidelines, it's not going to transcend those limitations. Exceeding its own authority under the Constitution. So that in and of itself, whatever the state board does.
And that you kind of get to in paragraph 2 of your motion.
Right, and actually paragraph 2 is that point. Paragraph 1, I'm trying to raise the other point, which was the second one, Mr. Carton, that you just raised, and that is that partly in view of the fact that the waivers are so constrained, and the state board's not going to be able to do much about those categories. Those are now going to be constitutionally defined categories. But if you couple that with the 20 student or more per grade level per school requirement before a non-accelerated English class has to be offered, there aren't going to be any programs to wade into. Somebody may well qualify for a waiver in Durango, and they'd have to be bused to Denver, perhaps. Obviously, I'm speculating, but who knows, in order to attend a bilingual class. We have no idea. But to suggest that enough students at a single grade level in a single school throughout the state will be able to qualify for waivers under these restrictive circumstances to have anything to wade into is something that I would suggest the voters need to know. So there really are those two elements, the restrictive waivers And in a way, I won't say the meaninglessness of the waivers, because they may have meaning in some geographical locations, but quite likely in others will not.
Well, can I get, and this will just...
And I think both should be reflected, by the way, in the initiative. Now, the second point didn't find reflection. It was present last time, and it wasn't reflected in the, in the language the Supreme Court approved. This time, I don't know, but the board is aware of that. But I think it's a very valid and extremely important point for voters to be apprised of. If they get a waiver, that isn't the end of the story. There isn't necessarily a class available for them.
Well, I guess what I would be wrestling with, if we come to that point, is, for example, if we were to insert language in the title that addressed point two, that gave notice that the waiver was available only... The condition precedent was that you either 10 years old or a special needs student, whether then we can say for certain that, and then I think that the language, thereby reducing the likelihood that bilingual education will be used from Measure 31, I think that's separate in my mind from whether or not there are restrictions that make getting a waiver difficult, because I'm just not sure we know or can speculate whether or not the restrictions, whether the state board will make it easy or easier.
Well, they can't make it very easy, Mr. Martin, because they're limited by the two constitutional categories. If a child doesn't have special needs or isn't 10 years of age or older, which sort of defines a group of grade levels and leaves out the group of grade levels, state board's not going to be able to do a whole lot to make it easier.
And I agree with you. That's constitutional language. So that's the threshold. That's the threshold. And if that language is in the title, what more, in your mind, if you had language that gave notice of those threshold requirements in the title, in your mind, do you still need language that talks about very restrictive circumstances or severely limiting circumstances for which waivers will be granted? Do you understand my question?
I think I do, Mr. Carton. Let me try. I mean, if I understand your question, last time the decision was made by the board not to specifically say 10 years of age or older or special needs or whatever, but to say severely restrictive circumstances, a language that was ultimately approved by the court. I think you could do one or the other. I'm not sure I particularly have a preference which one the board does, but I don't think you need to do both. But I think what you should do, and I argued this last time and somehow it evolved into the air, but I would certainly argue it again, is that on top of whichever of those language choices you make, I think the board should disclose that there is a question about the availability of programs to waive into. And I'm not quite sure how I would word that. Maybe Mr. Bodine would have some suggestions as a proponent, but I don't think that element can be left out.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ring. Mr. Bodine.
Thank you. Let me address probably in kind of similar to the same order Mr. Remy did as well. We'd suggest that there's some technical changes that can be made that would address several of his concerns or several of the concerns that were raised in the motion for rehearing. First of all, with paragraph 3, if you made the change online, let's see if I can get this right. On line 6, I believe, where am I looking? I guess I'm looking at the ballot title. Go to the other one. Just a second here. There we go. Line 5, I think. Talk about English immersion program, which is at the end of line 5, the beginning of line 6. If you change where it says English immersion and just made that accelerated English acquisition, gets a technical change just to bring it in line with the wording of the initiative. I think that's that resolves at least some issue, and then it would be the same change, of course, on the ballot title. Line 5. See if I can catch the other one here. In their motion for rehearing,
and
5 and 6, I think we could deal with that, I think, with a very technical change on line 15. where you would insert after enrolled in second grade or higher, you would insert at least once a year, comment to monitor their progress. I think that again, is kind of a technical change, but brings it in line with the wording of the initiative. For that issue, I believe. As far as line 16, I haven't given that a lot of thought, but that I think that could be changed to deal with his issue with the academic subject matter. It's not set forth in the initiative to talk about academic subject matter. It would just be nationally accepted test of English proficiency, and to make aggravated results of the test publicly available. So you'd be striking the academic subject matter given in or something of that nature. I'm not sure exact wording because I hadn't sat down and kind of agonized over the wording, but it would be something that I think it's easily enough and technically just a technical change. As far as dealing with the other issues, I think in 1 and 2, first part, I think we can do a technical change on line 7, strike the word annual, and insert right after waivers under very limited circumstances. Whether you wanted to detail those specific circumstances of over the age of 10 and special needs, leave that to the board. I think very limited circumstances probably meets the disclosure, I think, requirements that of the title, but that would be just a technical change in either way. So leave it at your discretion as in that regard. And the other issue that was raised, I think, is a matter of interpretation. Ramey feels that the issue raised with the waivers in subsection 5 in the initiative limits the things we talk about. Individual schools in which 20 students or more of a given grade level receive a waiver shall be required to offer such a class. Now that's true, of course, but the proponents, the intent was here was that each district that had students that would receive waivers, each district would have at least one class. Now that wasn't set forth specifically in here, but the wording talks about schools, doesn't mention districts as far as what the district would do. Some of this wording was established as far as the 20 students was based on some of the input that we had received from some school districts, talking about that they needed at least 20 students to have a class to make it economically feasible to run a class. If you have three people and you have to pay a teacher salary for three students, it becomes very much a burden on the school district. So that's why the 20 students was put in there. Perhaps it would have been more clear to mandate specifically that the district would have a class and therefore they could consolidate the students within the district in that bilingual if they had they didn't have sufficient within that grade level at an individual school. Mr. Ramey says that his interpretation of the wording is the fact that they might have to be bused essentially across the state, which would make it effectively of no value or therefore it couldn't be offered because you can't bus children across the state either economically or even effectively. Opponents believe that this gives, that the state board has the authority, under what's been written here in the initiative, to establish that each school district would have a bilingual class, even if within each grade level, even if there was less than 20. It's only dealing with each school rather than the school district. And that was the intent of the initiative, is that the school district would have, if they didn't have sufficient to run classes at each grade level within the schools, that the district would combine those various waiver students and put them in together into a class within the district, not necessarily within the state. Therefore, they would be able to bus them from one school within the district to another school of the district that would have a class at that grade level. That was the intent. I realize it's open to interpretation. Ramey interprets it, and probably the worst possible interpretation as far as the impact on the children. The proponents believe that the wording here and the authority given to the State Board of Education allows the State Board of Education to mandate that districts set up those classes within the district and consolidate those waiver students together into a class, even if there's not 20 there. And so therefore, I think any other way of addressing that obviously is going to create a substantive change in this initiative, and so therefore would oppose any major change in the wording at that point.
Any questions for Mr. Bodine? Thank you. Okay. Mr. Ramey, did you have anything you wanted to add?
I think the only point we're quibbling about is, and I may have missed something through the cracks here, but it's the last point Mr. Bodine was addressing. And I don't mean to pick the most egregious reading of the thing out of the air, but the language that I'm looking at in Section 5 of the text of the initiative is individuals, and I'm about four-fifths of the way down toward the bottom, with a line that starts with ending a sentence with the words by law. And then it states, individual schools in which 20 students or more of a given grade level receive a waiver shall be required to offer such a class. In all other cases, such students must be permitted to transfer to a public school in which such a class is offered. That's the language I'm looking at. And I appreciate Mr. Bodine's statement of intent, and I have no reason to doubt it. And I would certainly agree that Mr. Bodine's interpretation would make the operation of the initiative less egregious than I was describing a little while ago, but that's simply not what the language of the initiative says. It says something different. And I could certainly imagine if the State Board or somebody else tried to interpret it in the way that Mr. Bodine just suggested, notwithstanding the statement of intent made here today, someone could challenge that as inconsistent with the plain language of the constitutional provision that was adopted, and I think probably successfully challenged it on that basis. If indeed that was Mr. Bodine's intent, my suggestion, and I realize this will not go down well in all likelihood, is to go back and make an adjustment to the underlying measure, and I realize at this time of year that means the 2008 election cycle as opposed to the 2006 one. Nevertheless, that is a crucial item regarding the effectiveness of this waiver and whatever action this board takes on the title, because in one case, the second point that Mr. Carton and I were discussing looms huge, and that is that even with a waiver, there's probably nothing in most of the state to practically waive into, which is hugely important for the voters to know. Given Mr. Bodine's statement of intention, it's a different situation, and would certainly be expressed in the title in a different way. So I mean, my suggestion, if that's the intent, we or they ought to go back to the drawing board on this and make sure that the measure states that. This measure doesn't state that. And if the proponents go forward with this measure, I think the title clearly needs to reflect in some way, board is very creative at this, but in some way that it is quite likely, and I'm not sure what the phrase would be, that there will be nothing to wade into, even if a waiver is available.
Can I just want to discuss that point just a little? Well, maybe, but I do want to understand it better, because I'm just keep rereading the language. We know that individual schools, if there's 20 or more students, the individual schools are required to offer the class. Doesn't say they're prohibited from offering it if there's less.
Correct.
And if they don't, let's say there are less than 20 in any individual school, they don't have to offer it. But what the school district does have to do is to offer those kids transportation somewhere else. And it doesn't necessarily even mean in the school district, I don't think.
I think you're correct.
So, although they do have the alternative to send students anywhere, and then granted the students may not want to go, there are limits to how far students would want to go, there is a burden on those schools because they bear the transportation cost no matter how far it is. And so they could offer these classes even if there's less than 20 students. It might be a lot better. I mean, if you had 15, for example, I'm just guessing the economics are it'd be better to have the class for 15 than to bus 15 kids a long distance to another school, maybe.
Under those circumstances, Mr. Hobbs, I wouldn't quibble, but if you had 3 to 5 or 6, you know, a little school in rural Colorado, far from the metropolitan areas where there's at least a possibility that such a program would be required, I'm not sure, and again, listening to Mr. Bodine's own statements, which I think are accurate, I'm not sure it would be economically feasible either to offer an alternative program, or either economically or practically feasible to transport the students to a program, if any, somewhere. Your point's well taken, but it all depends, I think, Mr. Hobbs, on how many students we're talking about that actually qualify for the waiver, and you're positing a situation where, notwithstanding the limited circumstances under which the waiver is available, we're going to have 15 or close to 20 students, and a school district would decide, well, gee, let's go ahead, notwithstanding that we're not required, not required to offer such a program, let's go ahead and do it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
But I'm not sure that would be the case.
Yeah. Mr. Bodine, did you have anything further?
Oh. Mm. Quickly, I think you raise a good point, is that there's nothing that prohibits a school district from offering a class, or even a school from offering a class with less than the 20. I think that's an important consideration that, you know, well, I realize that if you only have 3, the economics for the school district are probably, say, well, we could bus them to Denver or whatever. But I think the political realities for the school board is that's probably not going to happen. I think they're going to probably come up with the money to run a class, even if there's only a handful of students that waver out and want the bilingual program.
Let me ask you one question about your suggestion about, I think it was in line 7, you suggested after waiver, the word waivers, inserting under very limited circumstances?
Yes.
I just want to ask you, that's one place to put that, but it strikes me that it may be better to put something like that in line 9 at the end of that clause. Well, maybe it doesn't matter. I think we're still in the same clause. Establishing requirements for the waivers under very limited circumstances, for
that
example.
That would work there as well. So either way the board feels is clear, it would be fine.
I mean, and partly why I'm asking that is I'm still trying to think through whether we need to also refer to the difficulty of obtaining the waivers. I think I see two different issues here that the Supreme Court referred to in the title for number 31. There's the difficulty in obtaining the waivers and the restrictions, the restricted qualifications. So, for example, what I'm trying to say is the restrictions are that the student has to be over 10 or a special needs student. That's for
correct.
Example, is a restriction. It's not, that by itself doesn't make it difficult, but it's restricting who can get the waivers.
And that's set forth in the initiative. As far as difficulty, we don't know yet because we left that to be guidelines to be established by the state board. And so how difficult is it going to be? I don't know. You know, I mean, and I think to put any kind of wording in there that talks about they're going to be difficult to be obtained is premature at this point because we don't have any idea what kind of guidelines the state board is going to establish for those.
Well, we do know some of the difficulties that are in the measure that were, I think, in the measure last time. They have to apply in writing. The parents have to apply in writing. They have to personally visit the school.
Mm-hmm.
They have to be provided a full description in a language they can understand of the educational materials to be used, etc. I'm not sure that's a difficulty, but it's another hurdle. So there's at least maybe three difficulties that have to be overcome.
I guess it's a matter of interpretation to some degree. These were not intended to be difficulties when they were placed in the initiative by the proponents. These were intended to ensure that the parents had sufficient understanding of what their options were before they made a decision. I don't think these were ever intended to make it more difficult or to make it more restrictive on receiving waivers. It was to ensure a full disclosure to the parents so that they could be able to make a decision on whether a waiver is something best for their child after they were given the full options that were there, and to make sure that they received that information in a language they could understand and comprehend. I guess if you want to look at it as making it more difficult because they have to go through this process, to some degree that's true, but the intent was not to make it difficult in the process, but instead to provide them with the information they needed so they could make an informed choice on whether the waiver is something that is in the best interest of their child.
Well, maybe I'm belaboring the point now, but I'm just trying to understand where we go from here, given what the Supreme Court told us last time. I mean, last time they said there's three things we needed to put in the title, I think. Mm-hmm. That the waivers were difficult to obtain.
That they were available under very, very restrictive circumstances.
And third, they can deny them for any reason or no reason at all. That third thing has been addressed.
Right.
But I'm not sure that the first two are any different.
Well, and I think it's very difficult to obtain, I think, goes to the fact that they could be denied for any reason or no reason. Okay, I think if you wanted to put in a statement or a prepositional clause or whatever in there, when you're talking about parents or legal guardians obtaining waivers, you might want to put in something after disclosure, full disclosure of options or something of that nature, because the intent of the proponents is that the parents understand what they're doing by requesting a waiver and asking for one. What kind of impact does that have on the education for the child? If they understand that, if they understand what their options are, fully understand it, then they can receive a waiver or based on whatever guidelines the Board of Education, of course, would set up. But that's what, at least the way I understand the proponents were looking at putting that information in there, was more of a disclosure to the parents rather than an impediment to obtaining the waiver. I mean, I don't think anybody would object as far as the proponents if you want to put something in there about a full disclosure to the parents as being a requirement for there, but to classify that as making it more difficult, I don't think that was ever the intent.
And to be even more direct here, I actually don't see that much difficulty, mm-hmm. but the Supreme Court said there was, and that's what I'm trying to figure out is why would we not say the same thing this time that we said last time? And I'm governed by what the Supreme Court told us to say.
And I understand that, but and I have to kind of go back to the thing. I think the reason the Supreme Court said that last time was because of that clause that it could be denied for any reason. Or no reason whatsoever. They could just out and out deny it. Now, the proponents feel that it's in the best interest of the children to learn English. I mean, as I mentioned the last time, the dropout rates for non-English speakers is unbelievably high. I just earlier today have received some information in Weld County for the three major non-English speaking elementary schools. And right now they have less than 30% proficiency on the non-English speaking students in those three schools. That does not bode well for the next few years when these students move forward into high school on whether they're going to actually be able to graduate. So this is intended to kind of address that to help give them greater opportunity. But if we don't educate the parents on what their options are, I think it makes it very difficult for parents to make any kind of informed decision as well. So I think the Supreme Court was focusing on the ease of which those waivers could be denied when they made the statements that they were very difficult to obtain.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Carton.
And I don't intend this as an argument, Mr. Chairman. I do One thing I would like to point out, just not for the sake of having an academic discussion here, but is that we do have different measures. This is a different measure from 31 in 2002. The measure at 31 in 2002 said the circumstances in which a parental exception waiver may be applied for under the section are as follows. And then I had three of those. One was children who already know English, and then went on with qualifying, explanatory language delineating exactly what that meant. Two older children, and then went on, the child is 10 years or older, the child is age 10 years or older, and it is the informed belief of the school principal and the educational staff in an alternative course of educational study, etc. And number three, children with special individual needs, and then a very lengthy paragraph, the child already has been placed for a period of not less than 30 calendar days during that particular school year. So I think that the circumstances in 31, arguably, are different than the circumstances in the measure before us. So I would say, if you're looking for a reason, if you're wondering why we shouldn't do, why the title board shouldn't follow the letter of case of proposed initiatives 2001-2002, number 21-22, there are differences, and I wasn't on the title board then. You were. Mr. Ramey was here. I think that there were circumstances. The current measure talks about students who may be eligible for a waiver include students who are 10 years of age or older and students with special needs. And it doesn't quite go into that lengthy explanation or delineation of the circumstance, what exactly that means, or how you qualify to be 10 years of age or older, or how you qualify to be a student with a special need. And so, I know where I'm. There's not a question in there, and there's not necessarily an argument in there, but I do think there are differences here. And so, and I go back to this very restrictive circumstances, or adding language to this measure about establishing requirements for the waivers under limited circumstances. You're proposing, I don't know if I'm adverse to that, but I still want to make sure there are limited circumstances present. And I do think that's a separate issue from whether or not, if the child is able to get the waiver, whether or not the discussion that Mr. Ramey just had about what the measure says about having to have 20 at grade level in order to have a program in the school, whether or not anything has changed in this measure from the previous measure on that particular provision. Or whether or not a court would look at that and say nothing's changed, you still got to have 20 at grade level in order to have the program. Therefore, it's going to be very difficult for anybody to go anywhere, thereby reducing the likelihood that bilingual education will be used. So that's what I appreciate your time.
And the proponents made every effort, I think, to try and get most of those decisions to the State Board of Education rather than setting it forth specifically in this constitutional change.
Okay, thank you. I don't have anyone else signed up to testify, but is there anybody else present who wishes to testify? If not, then I'll turn to board discussion with respect to the motion for rehearing, and are there any suggested changes to the titles previously set by the board? I'll make some suggestions. Maybe I'll stay away from some of the harder stuff here just for a moment. Sounds to me like there may be some general agreement about some of the issues raised in the motion for rehearing. Let me start at the bottom, I guess, of the title. It does strike me that line 16 is inaccurate when it refers to tests of academic subject matter given in English. So for the sake of discussion, and I think this was Mr. Bodine's suggestion, I'd move to strike phrase academic subject matter given in English and substitute English proficiency.
Second.
So that clause, that part of the clause anyway, would refer to a standardized nationally accepted test of English proficiency, comma, English proficiency. And a little p at the beginning of the word proficiency. That's been moved and seconded.
Any you just have an extra little p
in there. Oh. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Then I guess this in that same clause in line 15, after hire, comma, insert the phrase at least once a year, so that that clause would begin, and requiring schools to test children learning English, comma, enrolled in second grade or higher, comma, at least once a year to monitor their progress. Maybe a little awkward, but and I think that was Mr. Bodine's suggestion as well.
Offer an alternative to that?
Sure.
Just to say, higher, comma, to annually test their progress, etc. A few words less, all right?
That's okay with me. Mr. Bodine, you want to address that?
The only reason I use the at least once a year is because that was the wording exactly from the initiative, but if you think annually for less words says the same thing, and I don't really have issues. It's just kind of semantics.
It is simpler, and I think it's maybe clear enough. It is an annual requirement, and nothing would prohibit them from doing it more often, but the requirement is at least annually. Or at least once a year. So it would be annually to monitor.
Is that correct?
No, annually test their progress.
Oh, right. Thank you.
Well, you can just delete to monitor. Annually test, and then delete to monitor.
You could drop that THE, and then strike to monitor. I'll move that change then.
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Dunn. It would read requiring schools to test children learning English, comma, enrolled in the second grade or higher, comma.
Two.
Oh, there does seem to be a two missing then. Annually two test? I don't know, we're back to annually test? Split the infinitive? Any preferences? You have something.
Two annually tests.
You're going to split that infinitive.
You have two tests earlier.
Okay.
So if you put another two in there.
Two tests, children learning English.
Oh, I see.
Children learning English annually.
Two tests, children do that.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but I think that was my original thought, actually. But I'm not sure that works, because then you have and requiring schools to annually test children learning English enrolled in second grade or higher. Leave it the way it was, to monitor their progress using a standardized nationally accepted test. So the annual test applies to the to the original test, but not necessarily to the monitoring the student through a standardized nationally accepted test. It sounds like the way I read it right now is that there's an initial test to figure out where they are, and then there's an annual test to monitor their progress.
What if on line 14 you put annually before test?
If I could suggest that you just go there, it would be requiring schools to monitor the progress of. Requiring schools to annually test children learning English enrolled in. That's what we're talking about. To annually test children to monitor their progress using standardized English. To annually test, right? Children. To monitor their progress in learning English. I guess that we have to put that phrase in there about the second grade as well. It's always hard to do it at that.
Maybe we just drop the whole. Just say that. To annually test
English
proficiency of children in second grade or higher using an annualized or using a standardized nationally accepted test, et cetera.
Make a suggestion that we maybe come back to Mr. Hobbs's at least once in which is consistent with the language of the measure.
And at least.
And I think his suggestion was enrolled in second grade or higher, comma, at least once a year, comma.
That was my original suggestion.
The least elegant approach, but maybe the most effective.
Let me just try one other idea. To rephrase this to say requiring schools to monitor the progress of children learning English, comma, enrolled in second grade or higher, using a standardized nationally accepted test. I don't have the annual in there, but let me make another run at that. Requiring schools to monitor the progress of children learning English enrolled in second grade or higher using an annual standardized nationally accepted test.
That worked.
You think?
A lot of adjectives.
What, Mr. Carton, do you have a preference?
No, I don't have a preference.
But,
using an annual standardized?
Yeah, that's what's not very. That's kind of awkward. Using an annual test, an annual standardized nationally accepted test, or by annually using a standard. You know, monitor progress by annually
using
a standardized nationally accepted test, or administering. Maybe that's the simplest solution.
Just to
annually test children learning English enrolls. I mean, the only change would just be to insert annually in line 14, split the infinitive, and make no other changes.
That's probably fine, but there's two different testings going on in that sentence. There's an initial test, and then there's monitoring using a standardized test.
I was, and now maybe I'm getting tired, but I was viewing that not as two different tests, but it's one test, and then we're going to state what the purpose of that test is. It's to test children learning English for the purpose of monitoring their progress.
I think that's what the intent is. By the way it's phrased right now, that was my initial concern of why I didn't think we could just move that up a line, because it almost says you're supposed to give an annual test, but then you're also supposed to monitor them using some national test.
Motion? I don't know the way. I don't remember having a motion.
Well,
I'll make a motion.
Okay. Before you do that,
okay.
Maybe this is what you're saying. Insert the annually before test. So, in requiring schools to annually test children learning English enrolled in second grade or higher, and then just say using a standardized nationally accepted test.
That's fine with me. It just what it omits is why you're doing it, which is to monitor their progress.
And say, and in order to monitor perform progress, requiring schools to annually test children, blah blah blah. But Mr. Carton, I don't know how that fits with what the motion you were about to make.
The motion.
Why don't you come up to the podium? We do need to get you on the record.
I don't know if this work. I just say just requiring schools to monitor and annually test. Is that?
Doesn't help me, but.
I don't know. I think it's awkward no matter how we kind of go with it. So I'm not sure.
Mr. Carton.
I think that the insertion of the word annually on line 14, I think, is an appropriate change. The question I would have on line 15 is if I could just understand, Mr. Dunn, why you would want to strike the language to monitor their progress.
I just didn't think it really added anything.
Okay. And I think
that's implied in why you test annually.
I think I'd agree with that. I don't.
You could say, and in order to monitor student progress, comma, requiring schools to annually test children learning English in second grade or higher.
Well, as part of my motion, I'm going to move, in addition to the insertion of the word annually on line 14, that the words to monitor their progress on line 15 be stricken.
Yeah, I think that's what I said.
Yeah. I've been reluctant, but I'm happy to resolve this here quickly. So, like Sessie has it, Mr. Carton?
That's my motion.
I'll second that for discussion. Then that clause, first part of that clause would read, and requiring schools to annually test children learning English, comma, enrolled in second grade or higher, comma, using a standardized, nationally accepted test, et cetera. Pardon?
Just to back up and just throw this out there, I want to make sure that I think there's sometimes an issue of whether or not the changes that the title board makes are responsive to a motion for a rehearing. And so I think insertion of the word annually is in response to Mr. Ramey's motion, I'm searching for the paragraph here on paragraph 4. So I think in my mind that particular revision is responsive to paragraph 4 of the motion, striking the words to monitor their progress. I think it seems to me, I may be wrong, but we're striking that not on the request of either the Mr. Ramey or Mr. Bodine, that we're doing that on the board's kind of initiative to
streamline and clean it up, I think I heard from that.
If I could, number five.
Correction. It's actually paragraphs 5 and 6 that this addresses. Paragraph 4 has to deal with the waivers, the annual waivers. So paragraph 5 and 6, this has to do with just the testing, proficiency test,
that's right.
Which would be paragraph 5 and 6 in the rehearing motion.
Okay. Okay.
Rather than
thank you. Four. Thank you.
Well, and I think we do need to be careful about what we're doing on our own and what we're doing in response to the motion for rehearing, but I think I could rationalize that this is related because I think it comes up as part of our discussion about the two test and the two monitor, and this is already kind of an awkward clause, and I think in my view it's more important is to indicate that the test is annual than it is to say the reason why the test is given. And maybe they're both important. But it's just so awkward that I could support in dropping the monitoring purpose if in order to get the annually in there, but maybe I'm rationalizing.
I agree with you.
Okay. That's your motion, and I think I seconded it. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Dunn?
Before we proceed on with the easy ones, did we want to make a technical change to the measure itself? I know we've done that on a rehearing in a previous session this year, at the beginning of 7H, before I forget.
I think we did make that change.
Oh, is that the same one we made last time?
Yes, I think so.
It's just not in the version I have.
We didn't physically change what was submitted, but the board did approve that change.
Okay.
And that is confusing. And maybe in the future we ought to mark those, but I'm not sure. But that is, according to my notes, that's the change we approved last time. Well, I'll go back to the titles and make a motion in line 7 to strike the word annual. Second. I think there's agreement that at least is not expressly required. I think Mr. Dunn raised the possibility that because of enrollment every year, that may be implied, but it's been dropped in this version of the measure. It's not expressed in the measure. Any further discussion?
I think that's right, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. This gets a little tougher, but I'm jumping around here. I want to address the reference in lines 5 and 6 to English immersion programs, which is, I think, a carryover from the last version, and it's not accurate for this version. I'll just for the sake of discussion, the change I'm going to suggest is to strike towards the end of line 5 from the word placed. Strike placed in an English immersion program and substitute educated through accelerated English acquisition. I think that's the language from the measure. Let me add to my motion, or what will be my motion, I think, depending on what the discussion is. Let me add for at the end, after where the cursor is at acquisition, for a period. And I sort of feel like it's not quite right to say through acquisition that is intended. The acquisition, there's something wrong with the modifier there. So I'm trying to get to the time frame. I mean, I think actually the way it's written, a program that is intended to last 1 year might work, but
through an accelerated English acquisition program for intended to last 1 year.
Well, I was reluctant to use the word program because it wasn't in the measure. It would sure help. I mean, I don't mind thinking about that, but I don't think it's in the measure. So I hate to call it a program. But
curriculum?
Another word that's not in the measure.
Was it process?
Process. To be educated through an accelerated English acquisition process. And then maybe we would not need four period.
Jump to intended.
Yes, yes, please. And insert process. I sort of like that that is, I don't know. So the suggestion there, again, and just to repeat it for the record, is to be educated through an accelerated English acquisition process that is intended to last 1 year or less. I'll move that change. Is there a second?
Second.
Further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. I've addressed all the easy ones. Maybe I'll start with something that I'm not sure even I like, but just discuss the difficulty of the waivers. My initial suggestion would be to go to line, what is now line 9, at the end of that clause, and establishing requirements for the waivers, and insert after the word waivers right where you have the cursor, and I don't know whether it's worth typing yet, Ms. Gomez, but it would be something like establishing requirements for the waivers that are restrictive and difficult to obtain. And to me, as I indicated before, there's two different things that I'm trying to get at there. Restrictive refers to the fact that it's restricted to students that are 10 years of age or older or special needs. Difficult to obtain would refer to the process, submitting the application, writing, and attending or personally visiting the school and so forth. I'm not quite there yet that we need to say difficult to obtain, but there are some restrictions. And so if we need to say both, that's one possible way of economically referring to it.
And difficult to obtain.
I think so. Well, let's Ms. Gomez, let's go ahead and type it in at least. it'd be that that are restrictive and difficult to obtain.
That are,
or that yeah, wait. Well, it's kind of awkward now that I think about it, but. It's partly awkward, more look at it, because I'm mixing two different things here. It's the requirements that are restrictive, and it's the waivers that are difficult to obtain.
I was wondering if it was better to say establishing restrictive requirements for the waivers that are difficult to obtain.
I think that's better. That addresses the structural difficulty.
Yes.
Still not that great, but I mean, it's one of the premises here is that we still need to say that the waivers are difficult to obtain. And I am still struggling with that, whether that's true. And I think Mr. Carton actually was supporting the notion, perhaps, that that is another change, comparing this measure to the 2002 measure. You know, not only are the decisions now based on rules of the state board, but some of the requirements for getting the waivers are no longer present. And as Mr. Carton was talking about that, I was looking, for example, at the paragraph that deals with children with special individual needs. Roman numeral 3, there is a very long paragraph that was in the measure in 2002 about how to get a waiver for children with special individual needs. And it's pretty, I mean, for example, you have to provide a written description no fewer than 250 words documenting these special individual needs for the child. The waiver application must contain the original authorizing signatures of both the school principal and the local school superintendent. Cannot be applied for until after 30 instructional days of the given school year have passed. I mean, there's a whole bunch of difficulties that I don't think are in the current measure. And if I'm reading the measure now, the difficulties I referred to earlier, simply that you have to apply for the waiver in writing, you have to personally visit the school, and you have to obtain a full description of the educational materials to be used in the alternative program. That's about it as far as the procedural hurdles, I think, to obtain the waiver. There's still the difficulty of qualifying, being 10 years of age or older, or et cetera. And there's still the difficulty of, so what if you get the waiver, if there's fewer than 20 students to form a class? I mean, I'm kind of talking myself into dropping language about the difficulty of the waiver. But there's some risk in doing that. I mean, I don't want to do that if I'm given that the Supreme Court was pretty clear about the predecessor version. It's just that this version is so different than that one.
Any thoughts from the board?
It may be it's not as difficult as the previous measure, but I think I agree with Mr. Ramey when he discussed paragraph 5 of the measure that there are somewhat strict requirements. And I think we've run the risk you're talking about if we fail to mention that.
Mr. Garten.
And I guess following up on Mr. Hobbs's comments, I think that the title may get at those restrictive requirements for the waiver by adding the language, by adding the word restrictive requirements on line 9. And that this measure and the measures before the Supreme Court in 2002 do have substantive differences in those threshold requirements, the 10 years of age, the special needs, and children who already know English. And so I'm, although I agree with Mr. Hobbs, there, given that case, there may be an issue still of whether or not merely stating, establishing restrictive requirements for the waivers and not adding the language that are difficult to obtain on the basis that it's not as clear from this measure that's before us that the waiver, you have to go through so many hoops and there's so much discretion given on a school-by-school basis that there was in the initial measure. And so I guess I'm leaning towards limiting the change on line 9 and line 10 to the restrictive requirements language and not including that are difficult to obtain, because aside from all that, I think that the language restrictive requirements for the waivers may infer that the waivers are difficult to obtain as well. So
that's maybe I'm wondering the same thing. I mean, if we've done enough by saying there are restrictive requirements, restrictive requirements tend to imply that they're difficult to obtain. I mean, I'm really having trouble justifying including language that says the waivers are difficult to obtain. Now, at the same time, I'd be much more open to it if Mr. Bodine wanted it in there. And the only reason he would, I'm guessing, is there's a risk of overturning the title, a greater risk, I think, of overturning the title board. It's not there, to be perfectly frank. But as a title board member, I just have difficulty understanding why we would refer to the waivers being difficult to obtain. It seems, again, it just seems to me the parents have to put it in writing, which I don't know how difficult that is, and visit the school, and I don't know how difficult that is, and then comply with the rules of the state. It will qualify. I mean, this isn't procedural, but it would be the standard for the decision is the rules of the state board. But that doesn't increase the difficulty of applying. It may increase the difficulty of obtaining, I guess, the waivers, but we don't know that. So it's hard to say that the rules of the state board will make the waivers difficult to obtain. And what the Supreme Court observed last time is no longer true. They observed that the waiver request could be rejected for no reason at all, because there were no standards. So I guess where I am is simply to insert the word restrictive on line 9 and not refer to the difficulty of obtaining the waivers. I'm not sure we're agreed on that, but that's kind of where I am.
And I am as well.
If I haven't done this, for the sake of moving us on, let me just go ahead and make that motion that yes says if you'll strike that language there. My motion then is simply to insert the word restrictive on line 9 before the word requirements.
Second.
That's been moved and seconded. Is there any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1. Any other changes to the titles? Mr. Carton?
Well, I guess I had a question for the proponent, just one more time. The measure that was before the Supreme Court in 2002 had a clause in it that said individual schools in which 20 students or more of a given grade level receive a waiver shall be required to offer such a class. In all other cases, such students shall be permitted to transfer to a public school in which such class is offered. And there's language substantially similar to that provision in this measure. Do you agree with that?
Yes, it is nearly identical.
Right. And your testimony was that it's the intent, but it's not clearly stated in the measure that a school could go ahead and offer a bilingual education class. You don't have to get to the 20 at grade level threshold in order for a school to offer
that type. Correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct. As far as the proponents are concerned, there's nothing in there that restricts a school from offering a class with less than 20, just that they have to offer it if they have 20 per grade level.
And so my question is, in the preceding measure, the 2002 measure, there wasn't any language to that effect either.
Correct. But I think it coupled that with the real restrictive nature that they had in that initiative on the waivers, the two of them coupled together made that unlikely that much of that would occur as far as having bilingual classes.
Okay, so I'm reading from the 2002 decision. In the same way, the titles in this case create confusion and are misleading because they do not sufficiently inform the voters of the parental waiver process and its virtual elimination of bilingual education as a viable parental and school district option. And then when I look at the language of ballot number 31 from 2002, where the language was specifically inserted, thereby reducing the likelihood that bilingual education will be used, just asking you, are you satisfied that this title is sufficient without language in it that speaks to the likelihood of the availability of bilingual education given the requirements of this measure?
That's a tough one to answer for sure. Obviously, the proponents believe that this is distinguishable, significantly distinguishable from the prior initiative. Therefore, if challenged, we think that the Supreme Court could find that it's distinguishable and therefore support the this initiative and this title as currently written.
Thank you.
I'm not mistaken. Didn't I raise that issue last time? Felt that effect needed to be in the. I can't remember if we even voted on it or if I just raised the issue, but a concern of mine as well. I think I quoted the same language from the case.
I think that's correct. Well, I'm okay where we are right now, but I think there's some hard issues here. But are there any other suggested changes to the titles? If not, is there a motion to grant the motion for rehearing to the extent the board has amended the titles and deny the motion in all other respects.
So moved.
I'll second that. Let me read the titles as amended into the record. Ms. Gomez, I think we'll switch it so that it does not show the changes. And bear with me, but I think I just want to make sure we have a record here. The as amended, then, the title as designated and fixed by the board would read as follows. An amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the use of the English language in public education, comma, and, comma, in connection therewith, comma, requiring school districts to ascertain the number of students unable to perform ordinary classroom work in English and make the information publicly available, semicolon, requiring children to be taught by using the English language in their classrooms and requiring children who are learning English to be educated through an accelerated English acquisition process that is intended to last 1 year or less, semicolon, exempting from such requirements those children whose parents or legal guardians obtain waivers allowing the children to transfer to classes using bilingual education or other educational methodologies, and establishing restrictive requirements for the waivers, semicolon, requiring schools that grant any waivers to offer bilingual education or other educational methodologies when they have at least 20 students in the same grade who receive a waiver, and in all other cases permitting students to transfer to a public school in which bilingual education or other methodologies are offered, semicolon, charging the Department of Education with enforcing the measure by placing school districts on accreditation watch or withdrawing accreditation from school districts, semicolon, and requiring schools to annually test children learning English, comma, enrolled in second grade or higher, comma, using a standardized nationally accepted test of English proficiency, comma, and to make the aggregated results of the test publicly available, period, with the understanding that the same changes would be made in the ballot title and submission clause that follows. Any further discussion? That's been moved and seconded. If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That concludes action on number 95, and the time is 4:09 p.m. Let's take a 5-minute break.